Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Just before we get this next History Hack outing going, we would just like to extend the most incredible thanks to everybody for the support you've given us so far. The podcast has just passed 1 million downloads, which has completely blown our minds. So from Alex, Zach, myself, all the guys down the pub, we just want to say thank you so much. And to keep doing what you're doing, spread the word, tell your friends, like, subscribe, review. Remember, there's a Patreon. It's got its own Discord channel now where there's chat and things on it. There's Ko-Fi for dropping us a tip for an episode you'd like. There's the bookshop where all the latest books from our great guests are. And of course, just tell everybody about us, because the next million downloads we hope will come a lot quicker. And who knows what is going to come up in the next year. So thank you once again. I'm going to stop waffling. Here's the show. Hello and welcome to History Hacks, dedicated Second World War and a bit either side aviation podcast, Hedgehopping with me, Matt Bone. We've been off for a while, so I thought we'd come back and we'd have a bit of fun with this one. So I've asked a couple of mates to join me and we're going to just sort of put the world to rights, really, for a little while, talk about planes, talk about what's coming up on this over the summer, general bits and pieces, and see what they've both been up to, because we've had them both on the show before. I'm delighted to be welcomed, or welcoming even, Adam Berry and Matt Willis back to the show. So, Adam, you remember we had on with Seb, and we talked about how the 9th Troop Carrier Command were fantastic and everything that's been said about the worst trained pilots dropping the best trained soldiers was complete pants, which was good fun. And then we had Matt Willis, who brought us all up to speed with Allison Engine Mustangs. And I am a complete convert to the fact that they're the business now. So we'll start with Adam. How are you doing, sir? It's been a while.
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. Well, I say it's a while. We were at the Grand Prix together last year. We've seen each other since then.
That was a while ago now. It's nearly a year ago now. So getting close to a year ago now.
Yeah, it's scary how time flies.
Mad.
And Matt, it's been even longer, but how are you keeping, sir?
Yeah, not bad. Tired, post-viral fatigue and stuff, and lots of deadlines. But apart from that, plugging away. Was in the Lake District recently, so, you know, always anything's helped by going up a mountain, so that's nice.
Very good. And how's the dog?
Yeah, the dog's good. He's got two speeds, full and stop. So that's fun. He's going racing at the weekend, so that'll be nice.
Fantastic. I'm keen for this one because you guys have been really busy, because, you know, Matt seems to be every week you've got an article out. Adam, you've got volume two of your magnum opus due shortly, and it's sort of volume two and a half, isn't it? Because you've got extra bits on it. Yeah. Let's start with you, Adam. How has volume two come? Tell us about it. When do we get to see it? And it will remind me to go away and buy volume one.
When do you get to see it? That is, that, you know, that's the sort of how long's a piece of string cut type question. Because I have been a little bit lapse on my side of working on that book, because as I'm sure you're aware, Matt, me and Sophie were having an extension at home and I lost my office for a while. So having somewhere comfortable to work on the book has been difficult. But luckily for me, I co-author the book with a Dutch guy called Hans, who is, in my opinion, just about as knowledgeable as an individual can be on a specific subject, which is troop carrier operations, particularly during Market Garden. So he's been doing an awful lot of the legwork on it. He's been essentially putting together the chapters, but because he is Dutch, and although his English is very, very good, it takes me going in and, you know, reworking the chapters, adding bits in there that make it more readable for somebody that's not necessarily into, you know, the nitty-gritty details of the history of 9 Troop Carrier Command. Things like quotes and veteran testimonies and things like that that bring the story to life a little bit, and ultimately editing the book into something that can be published. The difficulty we had with Volume 1 was that we got so many photos from veterans' families, from veterans, from the archives, 70-75% of which had never been published before, that we had a very hard time picking and choosing what photos went into the book. And there are a lot of photos actually that we took out of the book that in an ideal scenario we would have left in. With Volume 2, we've got that problem but worse. Essentially, we've got such an incredible collection, talking in the region of maybe 2,500 images that were taken of. So Volume 2 will be 53rd Troop Carrier Wing. So for anyone who lives down in the sort of Wiltshire, Berkshire area, they were all based around that area of England. And picking and choosing what content we put in there is proving very difficult. So as you alluded to, it could potentially end up being two books sold as one, because we don't want to detract from the quality of the content of the book by, you know, chopping bits out. We want to be able to, you know, really showcase what these guys did. We're working on that at the moment. I say, you know, we don't really know when it'll come out. We really want it to be this year, but there's a lot of work to do. In the meantime, I've been working on a then and now book of Troop Carrier Command in the UK, which, again, I've been working on with Hans to try and bring in some of the photos that were excluded from Volume 1 and some of the photos that will be excluded from Volume 2 of these guys out on furlough in the UK, London, Nottingham, Newbury, Reading, all these sorts of places. And as a then and now book does, showing comparison photographs of what the places look like now. And they seem to be, theme-wise, quite popular books. So we thought, you know, why not? We'll have a bit of fun with that whilst we're working on the on Volume 2, because there's a little bit more of a relaxed process behind you know, putting that sort of book together. And plus, I find it very fun falling down a very, very deep rabbit hole of trying to figure out where certain photographs were taken by traipsing around the country on essentially Google Street View until we find the right spot, which is often successful, often not, but it's been fun nonetheless.
That sounds really good. Looking forward to that. Another thing to nag you about for when you're going to give me an update for it. But Matt, goodness, what haven't you been doing? It seems you've been terribly busy. Swordfish books due. The Mustang book's getting reprinted in a couple months.
Yep.
And as we've all now received our copies of Aeroplane for next month, you've done the most incredible database at the back of it for sort of British aviation from 1952 to now. So pick one, sell it. And,
yeah, well, okay. Well, I mean, I ought to sell the Swordfish book, because that's the one that will have royalties. But, you know, the Aeroplane one, I think I'm actually really quite proud of that. I'm generally happy with everything I do for Aeroplane. I'm quite lucky to have been able to do quite a lot of stuff for them this year. But the database was Ben Dunnell sort of came to me with the idea of saying we'll do something a little bit different for the database for this month, because this issue is the Platinum Jubilee issue, and that's kind of the main theme. For those who are not familiar with Aeroplane, the database is usually a feature or a series of features on a single aircraft type. So a potted history of the aircraft type, but not that potted, because, you know, usually you're talking about sort of, say, 8,000 words around about that on the entire history of a particular aircraft type. But Ben came to me and said, we'd like to do something on the whole British aviation industry from 1952 to the present. And being a naive idiot, I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. And, you know, it was a hell of a lot of work, as you'd imagine. Different kind of style of work to usual, because it's quite broad, but necessarily has to be quite shallow, because you have to cover a hell of a lot. And it was really interesting, actually, being able to take that step back and look at things from a broader perspective than you would normally be able to, and actually start sort of looking at the whole story and stories within the main story and following threads through. So, you know, things like air-to-air missiles from the outset, and you know, the development of rotorcraft and airliners and all the sort of, you know, because the usual thing is, I think the thing that to sort of sum it up, if it's possible to do so. The view that a lot of people have is basically one of decline, and that it started out in the 50s when, you know, Britain was a great aircraft aviation nation, able to compete with anyone in the world. And we were doing everything from, you know, military aircraft, airliners, rotorcraft. There wasn't anything we didn't do. We did it all ourselves. And then after that, there was, you know, horrible governments that cancel things and, you know, could have things that could have been world beaters or two. And then were, you know, terribly short-sightedly killed by appalling politicians and stuff like that. And the view I think I came to was that it's a lot more complicated than that. It's there are areas of withdrawal from certain areas of the industry, and areas that we've kind of got out of as a country that maybe we didn't need to and shouldn't have done. But on the other hand, some of the sort of technology that's now coming through and the way the United Kingdom fits into other projects, it's really kind of top of the game, and it's sort of specialization and development and evolution in through certain paths. And, you know, UK has taken one path and countries like France and so on have taken different ones, and I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. So yeah, it was an interesting process kind of trying to step back and put all of that together. So that's in the June issue of Aeroplane magazine.
And it's, yeah, it's great. There's some, you get the rotor dyne in there, which is always good to squeeze into any discussion. Mm. You kindly sent us it yesterday. We both, Adam and I, had a little flick through. It's when you say comprehensive, yeah, it's a big old read. So I haven't had the time to sit down with a cup of tea yet, but I've picked out a few bits. You've got, you know, fire streaks on javelins in there. The bit that if you can hear me clicking in the background, it's because I'm trying to find it, and it's, what, 23-25 pages of good content.
It's probably more than 12,000 words, actually. It's a good old chunk of text, and lots of pictures, which obviously, you know, Aeroplane's got such a great archive, and they're able to source photos from everywhere else as well. So it's, you know, it's really well illustrated, as they always do in my you know, not entirely unbiased view, but yeah, you know, it's a good one to keep. I think I hope it will be a half decent reference for people in the future as well, because it doesn't miss much out, I don't think, despite obviously being it's not a full book by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, we covered a lot of ground.
It's definitely a keeper. You know, often with these magazines, you find that some of them are a little bit, you know, once you've read them, but this one's definitely a keeper.
Mm, I'm glad to hear that.
It is. I subscribe to it because I like it, and that's not just because, you know, they got me to write something from. But it's a superb one. I'm going to enjoy delving into that a little bit more, because you also had that excellent one about the dear old Mr. Gray and his slagging off of the Soviet long distance attempt last month.
That one kind of started with when they did the anniversary piece for Aeroplane, which I now can't remember whether that was last year or the year before. But it was Ben again asked me to do a piece on C.G. Gray and his politics, which I think, you know, I'm quite grateful to Ben for having the faith in me to tackle that very sensitive subject. But
to be fair, you'd think the editor of Aeroplane would step up to write an article about the editor of Airplane, wouldn't you?
But, well, you know, this was a piece within a piece. So it was the database that month was on the history of Airplane magazine, and Arthur Ord Hume was doing it. It was, you know, I can't think of anyone better to do the overall piece. But one of the bits that, you know, I didn't really touch on in the end, because there was more of it in the main article, was this whole business of Gray challenging the legitimacy of the long distance record that the Russians had made in the Tupolev Ant 25 aircraft, which involved the sort of transpolar flights, which were quite sort of dramatic flights at the time, where, you know, nobody had made these flights directly over the pole, which is obviously now a commonly used route across continents, but this was sort of pioneering stuff. For that reason, and for the record setting, and they went to Gray, and he had his team go to some quite extreme lengths to prove that this couldn't be possible, and that, you know, they looked at the mathematics, and they had papers from the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics in the States, you know, which were all kind of enlisted in the service of proving that these aircraft weren't capable of making the flights. And I kind of thought, well, yeah, that's kind of been left hanging, because the FAI at the time decided that the records were legit. The various other countries were kind of, you know, pretty much recognized them straight away. But a lot of that, I think, was on the fact that, as Gray pointed out, you know, quite a lot of it is done on trust, and that it requires, like, the main aero club of the country concerned to do certain things to validate the record. And there was a question of whether you could trust what was essentially an authoritarian regime to be trustworthy over these things. But of course, you know, Gray didn't mind at all when it was Nazi Germany or fascist Italy that was carrying out record flights, because he had some, frankly, his views were offbeat even by the standards of the time. And, you know, he had some really out there views, which, you know, makes him quite controversial as a figure, because he's so important to the foundation of the aviation media in the UK, and really, and the establishment of aviation generally. You know, in the early days, he was really quite influential, but he was a frightful bigot, and he had some hideous views. And I think it's actually sort of, you know, it's quite good that the Aeroplane is, you know, they're not trying to hide that, they're actually engaging with that as a subject. And I think that's because, you know, the magazine was always political when Gray was in charge, and he made it that way. People say, take the politics out of aviation history and stuff. It's like, well, sorry, you know, can't do that. So, you know, trying to do that in a kind of sensitive and balanced way. And, you know, it's interesting to be able to explore things in that way rather than just, you know, nuts and bolts and top trumps.
And anything on Gray is catnip to me, because he's...
He's such a weirdo. Oh,
yeah. That's a whole other show, but and of course swordfishes, which you're,
yeah,
you know, boaty kind of boaty planes, which we tried to stay away from. That one's been a little while in the coming now, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. It was due to come out. God, when was it? It was basically delayed by the first lockdown, because the publisher Tempest Books anticipated that there would be, rightly so, that there will be sort of, you know, logistical issues with that. So that and another book that I'm working on they made the decision early to put those back. And then obviously they got into a queue with other stuff that I was working on and that the publisher was working on. So that has been a little bit of time, but I'm expecting that by the end of the month. And actually, it was lucky. It was good to have the delay, because it enabled me to include stuff that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise, not least interview materials with what must have been one of the last surviving operational Swordfish air crew, an observer by the name of Brian Riley, who's sadly no longer with us. But I was able to, you know, probably got about sort of maybe 12 or 14 hours of interview material with him, a tiny fraction of that, which makes it into the Swordfish book, because he was on Mack ships. And, you know, it's really interesting career that he was on Mack ships in the Atlantic, and then suddenly switched to Avengers, and then ended up in the Pacific in an Avenger. So I'm not sure how many people fought in both the Battle of the Atlantic and in the Pacific War as well. So yeah, and, you know, he was in the thick of the Sakishima Gunto raids. So yeah, I managed to get some additional material from him, and it's also the first book in which I do the artwork as well as the text and sourcing all the photographs and things like that. So the profile artwork, there'll be 16 profiles done by myself, so I'll be interested to see how people receive those, because I haven't had any examples of that kind of work published yet.
Fantastic. So, you know, goodness, you have been a busy boy, haven't you?
Tell me about it.
let's get on to the summer, because it's our first summer in a couple of years where stuff is properly happening. And we were chatting about this a little bit before, sort of knocking around with, you know, projects that are going on, air shows, and of course we've got some interesting looking films coming out. But I thought, Adam, let's start with you. What's sort of top of your hit list besides returning to Silverstone for reasons that I will not be joining you for this year, but I'm sure it'll be fantastic.
I mean, obviously, I'd love to get back to their shows. I missed them tremendously last year, and was it the year before we didn't have any as well? Obviously, very gutted about the situation with Flying Legends, because, you know, Flying Legends is what it is. It's for those of us that are into the older style of aircraft, then it's, you know, one of the go-to air shows. So it's disappointing to see that there's not been the plans put in place, I believe, to move to Sidwell, sort of seem to have fallen down. Other than that, I'm air show wise, I'm sort of keeping my eyes open. I mean, the Victory Show is going ahead again, which is local to me, and that is usually a pretty good show for flying. I don't know the ins and outs of it really, but I get the impression that some of the limitations that get put on aircraft at air shows don't necessarily apply to the Victory Show. Obviously, they're not allowed to fly with a flight line, but you get up close and personal with the aircraft. You see them landing on a grass strip, which is nice and close, which is not very often you get to see Second World War aircraft landing on a grass strip. It certainly makes for good photographs. So I'm looking forward to that. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, I'll keep my sort of, you know, ear open to what's going on. And if I'm around, I'll try and make way to whatever I can.
Yeah, I've not got anything booked up myself yet. So hoping to pop up to Shuttleworth for a couple, because they always put a good show as well. Matt, have you got anything lined up? Are you?
Yeah, I'm due to go to Riyadh, which I haven't been to for, you know, a good few years. And obviously, that's not been on for a couple of years. So it's be interesting to see what they do manage to get together for that. You know, disappointing that Yeovilton Air Day is not happening this year, I think for financial reasons, they've said, which, you know, is not terribly surprising, but it's a pity, because I've been the last couple of examples of that. I was actually there with the Ferry Barracuda restoration team rather than as a spectator, but it's you know, it was good to go to anyway. Always a great static display there as well, and so it's a shame. Hopefully that'll be back next year. So with the, you know, loss of Caldros in the last little while as well, that's shame to not have Yeovilton this year. But yeah, React should be interesting. Other than that, I'm again not really booked in for much this year, but hoping to. I've done one of the Threshold Aero photo shoots, I've done more of them than air shows in the last few years, actually. A sort of, you know, although there's no actual flying, it's actually a good and different way to get sort of, you know, up close to operating aircraft and, you know, get interesting things thrown in with reenactors and things like that. So, you know, there was some, you know, lovely to see the newly restored Max Holst Broussard at Oaksey Park recently, which hoping to see that on the display circuit this season as well. That's a lovely aeroplane and quite a rarity. So nice to see that kind of spitting blue exhaust flames in the in front of a starry sky. So yeah, I love that kind of thing.
Fantastic. Let's get on to projects. You've mentioned the Barracuda, but I'm going to go to Adam, because there's one project we've been watching that they're starting to kit things out in a big way with Charlie's Night Fright, aren't they?
Yeah, I was going to mention actually a minute ago that obviously that's probably, fingers crossed, I spoke to Charlie recently about where they stand with the project, and you know, it feels like there's been sort of stops and starts with it, but he's hopeful that they'll get it in the air this year. So that's huge, because as you know, it's you know, okay, there's plenty of C-47s that are airworthy. There's plenty of C-47s that are airworthy with a great history behind them. But the project in general, with Charlie and the team that are restoring Night Fright, the details that they are going, the lengths they're going to make it potentially the most original C-47 flying, it's mind-blowing. I mean, aside from the instruments that they're sort of legally obliged to put in the cockpit, they are, it's going to be about as original as they come, really. I know they're having issues with obtaining the correct floor, but which to the, you know, to anyone who doesn't really care, doesn't seem like a great deal, but there was a difference between the type of floor that the Night Fright would have had and the type of floor that's sort of readily available from a lot of the post-war modded C-47s, and they want the real floor, which is commendable. They want it to be as original as possible. And of course, the fact that it would fly out of memory as well, its wartime home, is incredibly unique. A conversation with a number of people, and I can't really think of another warbird that does that or will, you know, is in a position to fly out of the airfield it flew from operationally during World War II. And having seen the plans they've got in place for what they want to do with memory, you know, with the museum, I don't want to say too much, but I know that Charlie's looking at another aircraft as well. Hopefully it'll be kind of a bit like an East Kirkby, but for troop carrier stuff, which would be great. Hopefully it'll be a little bit like stepping back in time. You know, fingers crossed they can get it in the air this year, and hopefully I'll get to have a little ride on it. That'd be great.
Yeah, he did mention that to me as well. So I need to touch base with him today. Doesn't forget.
It's just all these little gentle reminders every now and then. But he did actually say that.
Yes. I think I have him recorded saying it as well, which I didn't use in the podcast. So I'm going to hold that against him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's exciting stuff.
And Matt, the Barracuda Project have been posting some really, really cool things recently. Have you been speaking to them? Well, I guess you would have been, wouldn't you? But how are they getting on?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing well. I mean, it's obviously slow going because of the nature of the project. And obviously COVID, it hit them like it hit everyone else. But, you know, they've been getting back into it and, you know, working on it piece by piece. And it's only a small team working on it, but they're dedicated and they're doing, you know, they have their weekly updates on Facebook, which are, you know, one reason not to delete Facebook. And although, to be honest, you can look at the updates even if you're not, even if you don't have an account, I think. But, you know, it's the level of detail they're working to is just absolutely fabulous. And the way they're able to take these kind of, you know, bent and corroded and totally messed up original components and create out of them something that is incredibly original and yet looks pretty much like new, and doing this at, you know, at the level of an individual component that's, you know, inches across. And so, you know, it'll be a long time before we see something that looks like an aeroplane, but it is coming together. And I think they made a decision a little while ago that the intention from the outset was that this was going to be DP-872, which was the Bolton Paul built Barracuda, which had crashed into it's often described as a peat bog. It actually wasn't a peat bog. It was, you know, kind of the shore of a boggy area, the shore of a lake. And that it would be as original to DP-872 as possible. They use as much of DP-872. And obviously this kind of, it creates its own problems, because if you've got kind of a, you know, battered, you know, terribly corroded piece from DP-872, you know, it takes some work to get that back to a usable condition, whereas you might have a much better example from a different Barracuda wreck, or you might be able to fabricate something from new. And I know there was a couple of examples where they'd had some tubes fabricated because they're, you know, you can't get that spec commercially anymore. And then they got this wreck up from the Solent, and that had examples of original ones on. So it was like, well, yes, we've got these nice new ones, but we want this to be as original as possible. So we will work on the original fabric. So I think they've made a decision that it will be more of a kind of slightly more of a generic rebuild than the very, very specific restoration of DP872. But that said, they are still have the intention to make it as original as reasonably possible within the sort of time and resources that they have available. And I think, you know, the stuff they've done already is remarkable on that. But I think they've got slightly more focus now on, okay, we need to get a Barracuda out of this rather than just lots of really cool components. But, you know, it's they're doing such a fantastic job on it. And it's, you know, when you go to the museum, go to the Fleet Air Arm Museum, they're there and you can go and see them working on it at certain days of the week. So, you know, I recommend doing that as well as following them on Facebook. But it's all this stuff that you see when they're doing a restoration, you won't see when the aircraft is finished. So, you know, it's worth kind of following this to sort of the you know, I'm learning, I've written a book on the Barracuda and I've learned so much stuff about the internal structures and systems that I just didn't get into when writing the book. So, you know, it's that one's awesome.
Great. I've just been having beers with Tony Hoskins about AA810. So that's the one that's sort of on my mind. And that's, yes, keep an eye out on Tony's various feeds for that, because there's lots of cool news coming up for that one, which of course being a Great Escape pilot in it, and we might even mention one of 810's other pilots a bit later when we talk about racing pilots. But let's crack on, because we've got some movies coming up this summer as well. There's the big one, which frankly I'm stupidly excited for, which has got nothing to do with Second World War. Well, it does actually. It's Top Gun 2, which apparently is just incredible. Now, the reason I actually really want to see it is I want to figure out how they work in a naval aviator on naval aviator's pay getting a Mustang, and why would a naval aviator have an Air Force fighter and not a Hellcat? Or, okay, so that's got to be a pull-up point they sort out for me. But of course it's Tom's Mustang, so he's going to get it in for tax purposes, isn't he? Am I alone in being like stupidly excited about this, or are you guys kind of keen?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. The original Top Gun for me is if it's on, watch it type film. And there's not many that I can say that about, Forrest Gump being another. And because of my age, Ghostbusters being another, which is slightly different themes. But Top Gun is if it's on, watch it. I'm a huge, huge fan of the F-14. So it's a little bit gutting that obviously the new one, we're moving to a different aircraft altogether. One that I must admit, I've never really been too enamoured with. It's not quite hit me the same way that the Tomcat did when the original Top Gun came out. But that said, having seen what I've seen, some of the flying scenes in it look absolutely mind-blowing. I've been told that it's going to be better than the original. It's got to go some way to being better than the original. But if it is, then great. So yes, you're not alone. I am very much looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, me too. And I think also I'm a big Hornet fan. Because I'm a weirdo and a contrarian. I'm more of a Hornet fan than a Tomcat fan.
And thank you very much for joining us, Matt. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh God, you are not going to like what I have to say about the Tomcat in the Hush Kit podcast, but we won't talk about that. Anyway, I'm basically going to torpedo my entire career with that podcast. So you know,
it's Joe. You won't be the first, and you won't be the last to torpedo a career on Hush Kit. Will you?
Taken me this time to build it up again after the last time. And anyway, yeah, no, and just yeah, like you say, Adam, the in-flight stuff, the air-to-air stuff, just looks phenomenal. And I'm a being a kind of a cinephile and a VFX fan, and also a real kind of I love physical VFX, special effects done for real physical stuff actually you're doing real things with real aeroplanes. And it just looks like, you know, even if the story's crap, the characters you can't engage with, what have you, even, you know, any of that, it'll just be worth watching. So yeah, I will have to try and, I will no doubt watch it several times with different hats on and probably try and see it several times on as big a screen as possible, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm hoping to go with one of our down the pub guest judges, Simon London, to see it on the IMAX at Waterloo, because I think as big a screen as you can, even if it, you know, don't wait for it on your telly, folks. Get out and see it on something big. The other thing that I think will look really good on the big screen is the Lancaster documentary, which has been another thing that's been a long time coming. Personally, I'm not sure. I had real problems with the Spitfire one. I thought it was a little bit too misty-eyed for what it could be. But from some of the clips, especially with the there's Elsa, the German lady that they've got talking about the experience of being a civilian in Germany during a raid, I think it looks more, I don't want to say rounded. I haven't seen it yet. I've just seen the trailers. But I think there's, just from that, it seems that they've taken a little bit more of a 360 view, which I'm looking forward to. It looks fantastic. So I think that's...
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
I actually haven't seen the Spitfire one, largely because just so much about the Spitfire lacks nuance. And I just got the impression from the trailers that it was just going to be pretty much the sort of same. You know, it's got to the point where it's about the legend rather than about the reality. And it's interesting to hear you say that the Lancaster one, it sounds like they haven't done that so much. I mean, it's not quite, the aircraft doesn't quite have the same sort of mythos. Well, it does have quite a big one, but it, you know, it's, I think because of the nature of what it is and what it did, it's a little bit harder to mythologize in quite the same way. So that sounds interesting. And some of the, just the, again, the aerial footage that they've got from it and so on just looks just gorgeous. So
in the trailer there's a scene of the BBMF Lank taking off towards camera, and I've always been of the opinion that the frontal view of a Lancaster is when it looks most awesome. You know, it just looks like it's the best view, and I think that scene alone is worth watching. I'll watch it. If it's about a Lancaster, I'll watch it. But yeah, hopefully it'll be pretty good.
I'm with you, Matt. There's the nature of the aircraft leads to needing to tell a more nuanced story, whereas the Spitfire is a Spitfire. To be fair, the Spitfire doc is basically the documentary that they made if you'd only ever seen First of the Few.
Right.
They draw that line, and it's very sort of stirring scores, and yeah, and Jeff Wellham, you can't watch Jeff without smiling, because yeah,
Jeff. True. Yeah.
But it does what you expect it to do. Now, I did send you the link to a trailer which I found the other day for a very, I've just called it, odd Spitfire movie in our notes. Because it's done by the guys who did Lancaster Skies, which, again, wasn't great, but for the budget that they had, was quite impressive for what they've done. So they've done the same sort of thing again with a PRU Spitfire. Mm. And I sent it just for the thing, because I also sent it to Tony Hoskins, and he just went, yeah, I've been watching that, because it's literally his bag. But I was just wondering... We're just talking about trailers here, folks. So if you're bored, you know, come back in a couple of minutes. I like what this team is doing on a teeny tiny budget. Granted, I think they should spend more time on the script based on the trailer, but I was wanting to get your sort of feelings for these little passion projects, which, you know, the internet and these things allow us. What are sort of your feelings for something like that?
I wanted to like this. And I will watch the film. I'd say I wanted to like Lancaster Skies, but I couldn't finish watching it. I probably should have. I didn't get to the point. I presume they go flying in a Lancaster at some point and do some operations. I didn't actually get that far. But, you know, talking about the passion projects, the one I would really want to flag up is the Lano Hawker film, which is, you know, it's being made with David Bremner, his Bristol Scout. They've done some great, they've got a mock-up Bristol Scout that they've got on a gimbal and use that for filming. And some of the stuff that, you know, there are clips around that actually look really good and the quality looks amazing, and some good model work as well. So I would kind of encourage people to seek that one out. A bit of First World War air combat. Yeah, I don't know if that's the finished CGI that's on the Spitfire film, because it looked a little unfinished to me just on the small screen. So I don't know how it's going to look in the real thing. But as someone who does Second World War fiction as well as the non-fiction stuff, it's, you know, I do want more stuff like this. I like it to be done really well, and I just have I don't want to slag it off before the films come out. I'll keep an eye on it, and you know, and some of the stuff they've got, like the Spitfire cockpit and the clothing and stuff like that, looks done well. So fingers crossed.
It's called Spitfire Over Berlin, by the way. It's not called Odd Spitfire Movie, so don't go googling that. You'll find something very strange. Sorry, Adam.
I was gonna say I think that they're I think that they're more, regardless of, well, you can live with some of the quality if there's a right sort of passion there, and a willingness from the people who made it to, you know, really delve deep into researching whatever it is that they're theming it on. You know, and it looks like these guys have done a reasonable job with that from what, you know, you can see in the trailer. A friend of mine sent me a link a week or so ago to a film. It's slightly off topic, but it's about the second Ranger Battalion landing at Pointe du Hoc in Normandy on D-Day. And it is mind-blowingly atrocious. It's borderline comedy, you know, kit-wise, everything you can think of-wise. And evidently, something like that is created with the frame of mind that somebody just decided that they wanted to, you know, they might make other genres of film, but they might have decided they wanted to make a war film. Whereas with, you know, with some of these, like you say, passion projects, you can tell that there is some real passion for what they're doing there. And some actual effort has gone into researching them and making sure that everything they do kit wise and, you know, dialogue wise is pretty accurate. Because, you know, dialogue's a huge thing in these things. You know, people, you know, it sounds like a weird thing to say. People talk differently to how we do now. An example I was told the other day, which is, again, going slightly off topic, was during the filming of Masters of the Air, which, of course, is something else that hopefully we may see this year. I think the plan is to see it this year. They were using a Vietnam-era way of referring to lieutenants on set, a way which was never used during the Second World War. And it was picked up by a historical advisor, and the producer or the director who was filming the scenes in which this dialogue was used had an entire day's worth of shots reshot using the correct dialogue, which is what you want to hear on something like this, because, you know, these things, these little details make all the difference really at the end of the day. So yeah, if people are willing to put that time in and, you know, really, really do their research, then they can be, you know, you can kind of look beyond the quality or, you know, any of the sort of CGI on there.
Mm. No, that's fair, actually. And also, I think the one thing I did want to say was the fact that it's a photo reconnaissance Spitfire and the story is based around photo reconnaissance rather than air combat is actually, you know, definite points for them for doing that part of the story and telling something that's sort of, yeah, it's a Spitfire, but it's not your average Spitfire. And I would say, you know, things like, I think what put me off slightly about Lancaster Skies was, you know, things like the, you know, having WAFs just wandering around the men's accommodation on an RAF station and things like that in 1942, and understand why they would do it for the narrative. But, you know, things like that, you just look at it and it's hard to suspend disbelief with things like that. There are other much bigger productions that have done worse. So it is what it is.
Yeah, I think Masters of the Sky is.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Is the big one. I'm going to name drop here. I was at an event and I was chatting to John Orloff, and he broke out his iPhone and started showing me pictures. And the two B-17s that they've made are actually, they're taxiable, but they're like big remote control things.
It's so
cool. There's literally like a guy with like an airplane remote controller, and he's just driving the B-17s around on it with these big electric motors on the wheels. But then you sort of start zooming into what detail they put on to the static aircraft, and then the whole cockpit that they can sort of expand out sections of to put cameras. It looks incredible, which you would kind of expect from the insane amounts of money Apple paying on it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough to know a few people that have worked on the behind the scenes on there as historical advisors, and had a conversation on the phone with one 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I voiced a concern that it would be maybe a little bit like Band of Brothers and sort of play with the history a little bit, because there were rumors around about certain things they were trying to do which wouldn't be historically, you know, accurate for it. And I essentially sort of said to him, you know, ease my mind a bit, tell me that it's going to be good. And he said, you know, it is going to be very, very good. And this guy knows his stuff. And he's, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying so, very hard to please when it comes to this sort of historical accuracy in films. So for him to say that, it's, you know, it's a bit more reassuring. And like, you know, like you, Matt, I've seen some incredible photos of some of the set dressing and, as you say, the mock-up B-17s. And also, if you take a look at aerial photographs of the area around the tower at the real Thorpe Abbotts, the detail they've gone into in placement of the buildings and everything around the tower for it, it's, you know, it's exactly right, which they don't often do on things like this, because I suppose they don't really think it matters. I wouldn't want to say it again on here, but having heard what the rumoured spend has been, it's absolutely, you know, it boggles the mind, the amount of money that's been spent on it. So hopefully it'll be worth it.
Yep. It looks something.
I was going to say, have we seen the production that Shoot Aviation was working on with their Bouchons and Messerschmitt 108s in desert camouflage? Because whatever the hell that was, I'm really, really interested to see it.
That might be the SAS thing.
That's what I heard, yeah. That's what I heard. And I believe that's out now. Has it started? Rogue SAS is called, isn't it, I think? Something along the lines of.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye out for that then.
Rogue Warriors, isn't it?
That's the one.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, let's have this is great radio, folks. All of us Googling when this thing's out.
sorry, I should have, all these things that I should have thought of before.
I don't think it is out yet. Anyways, it's soon, but it's the Ben McIntyre empire rolling on with, you know, Operation Mincemeat in the cinemas, which I haven't seen, and from what I've heard, I don't need to see.
I haven't actually read any reviews or seen any opinions on that film yet, but it doesn't sound positive.
I've got the book. The book was good.
Yeah,
read it on a flight. It's not particularly hard going.
Honestly, I'll just sort of say at this point that if anyone wants to make a an adaptation of my Malta trilogy, then, you know, I don't care if you ruin it, just make it, you know.
Yeah. make you lots of money. Yes.
Well, you know, I don't even care about that either. I just want to see it on the screen.
Mm.
Here you go. One of my favorite Second World War based movies is Malta's Story. It's the most un-Guinness Alec Guinness performance ever, because he's so restrained, but it's fab. Anyways, we must move on. Books, anything got you? You both have stuff coming up, but are you looking forward to actually reading anything that's for pleasure? I would like to read something for pleasure, but this podcast means I have a stack of books I need to read to talk to good people like yourself.
Same, really. Yeah, I would love to read something for pleasure. I can't remember the last time I did, to be honest with you.
I'm probably going to pick up, just because of my love for all things US Airborne, I'm probably going to pick up the book about Ron Spears, because judging by the interview with the authors that our friend Paul Woodhouse did on his World War II TV, it sounds like it's quite revealing in terms of some of the stories that were made famous through Band of Brothers and his portrayal in Band of Brothers. So, but for me, that will be hopefully that'll just be an easy reader. That'll just be something, like you say, that I read for my enjoyment more than anything. Like you guys, I've not read anything. The amount of books, I'm sure it's the same with you guys, the amount of books I've got on shelves that are half read with post-it notes hanging out of them is alarming. And my wife is often saying to me, how many of these books have you actually read? And it's most of them, but define what you mean by reading. Do you mean having read the whole thing, or, you know, read a couple of pages? That's the only one really at the moment that I'm contemplating buying a copy of.
I actually read something for fun the other month. I went back and reread Goodbye Mickey Mouse.
Oh, such a good book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I must have been a teenager when I read it last time, and it superb, superb book.
Yeah, you lost on me with that one.
Right. Len Dighton, about a group of P-51 pilots.
Oh, right. Okay. I'll have to have a look at it.
It's not a hard read at all. You'll polish it off quite quickly, but it's...
I tell a lie. There is another book that's not new, but I do want to get hold of, and that's Richard Tregaskis, the book he wrote about Guadalcanal. Because apparently the way that he writes this is a great portrayal of the horrors of the sort of combat that the Marines faced on Guadalcanal. Again, it's not aviation themed, but it's it sounds naive of me, but I didn't know, although I knew he was there, I thought he was there, you know, as a reporter, and that he was, you know, sending snippets back to be published in newspapers or magazines or whatever. I didn't actually know he'd written a book until about 2 weeks ago. So I thought to myself, well, that sounds like a good read. So that's another one that I'm going to try and get a copy of. I'm assuming, given the magnitude of the name, that it will still be available, hopefully.
My B-25 kick at the moment, it's never been published here, but Tom McKeever wrote a book about the wing that Joe Heller was in called Bridge Busters, all about Tactical Mitchells. So I'm trying to find a copy of that that isn't an absolute fortune, then has to come from America.
Yeah.
But it's not due out until October. And the nice people at Osprey don't have any. So there we go. But anyways, that's it. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, there will be a lot of shows coming up about B-25 Mitchells in a little while. Sorry, Matt, you're going to say something.
While we're on the subject of books, I can kind of shoehorn it in, which is another screen adaptation I'm looking forward to, which I forgot to mention before, is The Shepherd, the adaptation of the Frederick Forsyth novella, which I think John Travolta was financing and directing, I think. But so, you know, D.H. Vampire, it's a beautiful book. And certainly the early editions were kind of really beautifully illustrated with pencil drawings as well. I imagine it'll just be a shortish film because it's only a short book. But there was a radio adaptation of it a few years ago that was on BBC, and it was a Christmas Eve thing. And it's apparently like just a passion project for John Travolta, because obviously being a pilot himself, but he loves the book, apparently. So they were doing some filming of that. I can't remember where recently, somewhere in the UK, with an actual vampire. So, fingers crossed it's good.
It, it was in Suffolk, and he was in a Wetherspoons. So there we go. So he was rocking the spoons, people.
The authentic British experience.
Okay, so we want to shoehorn a just quick chat about Formula One, but we started talking about racing pilots in our little group chat earlier, and I ended up in massive rabbit holes. But just to give a shout out to some great racing pilots that we were talking about earlier. Who wants to give people a rabbit hole to go down? Because I've got mine, which I'm going to save to the end.
Well, I'll jump in with Chris Staniland, who was ferry test pilot before the war in the 1930s. He was actually killed in a firefly during the Second World War. But he was...
A structural failure. I'll just throw that in. It wasn't just Hockerock that had structural failures, people.
Yeah, but he was a failure of the aircraft. It wasn't a piloting error. Yeah, he was a really accomplished racing driver as well. It was kind of old school stuff. He was mainly racing at Brooklands. So he wasn't particularly sort of on the international circuit, but he had a car which it started out as a Grand Prix Alfa Romeo, and being kind of a skilled engineer as well as a driver, kind of updated it and modified it sort of out of all recognition from the original Alfa Romeo. It was known sort of half jokingly as the multi-union, because bits and pieces of various cars had gone into it. And obviously it was a kind of play on auto union, which were around at the time. And it did look rather like a Grand Prix Mercedes by the time he finished with it. And he sort of set various lap records. I think he set an absolute outer circuit record in it before it was broken by John Cobb. He certainly set class records. And the other ferry test pilot, Duncan Mingus, who I wrote a biography of several years ago, who sort of, he drove with Staniland once in his Bentley, and Staniland drove him from one, you know, it's like they were going from one aerodrome to another. And he was driving this thing like he was on the race circuit. And Mingus basically wrote in a letter that, you know, he'd been driven by Staniland once, he refused to go with him again. Not because he wasn't an excellent driver, which, you know, Mingus is at pains to point out that, you know, he was a really, really good driver. But it was that he made no allowances for other road users not being of the same quality as he was. So reading between the lines, I think Mingus was scared half to death. He was kind of this kind of typical daredevil in the way he did everything, but he was a really kind of precise display pilot. And Mingus was an awesome display pilot. You know, he's a really good aerobatic pilot himself, but he you know, he was first to admit that that he wasn't even on Staniland's level as a presentation pilot. And I think those skills were the same skills that I think what we would call car control now. Staniland had just that total precision. Yeah, so I think it's sort of, you know, his career as a racing driver is not terribly well known. Sadly, his car, which survived the war, and it was in kind of pretty complete condition. I think the engine had blown, but apart from that, you know, this kind of unique car that had been built by this sort of important figure in British aviation and motor racing, but because it contained, by now, the only two, but it contained part of the chassis rails of an original Alfa Romeo, which had Grand Prix history, someone took it and basically junked all the stuff that was that had been added to it over the years, took the chassis rails and restored a Grand Prix Alfa Romeo. So now we've got this kind of these two chassis rails parading around, presenting as an original pre-war Alfa Romeo, which they probably claim had Nuvolari history and things like that, but probably didn't. So his car kind of still exists. And apparently the sort of like the multi-union bodywork is still in a garage somewhere. But, you know, I better stop there because otherwise I'm just going to rant about restorations. But yeah, that's so Chris Staniland, that aspect of him you may not have heard of.
Was it Ken? I've got Ken Ellis's test pilot books, and the final entry for Staniland was the irrepressible Staniland, the 37-year-old, died as he'd lived in the fast lane. There you go.
Yeah, and to be honest, I've heard some stuff some other stuff about Staniland, which I'm not allowed to publish.
Anyone for you, Adam, or shall I
jump? Well, obviously, I was reminded earlier of Tony Gaze, the Australian Spitfire pilot, a fighter ace, who was in F1 and Le Mans. But to be honest with you, we, you know, don't know a great deal about his wartime experiences. But, you know, if Wikipedia is to be believed, had 13 and a half kills to his name. So he seemed to be a pretty accomplished fighter pilot. But one in fact came across early, which I didn't know, and I'm wondering whether or not either of you two know this, but do you know who owned the Indianapolis Motor Speedway during World War II?
During World War II? Interesting. Ooh. No, I don't.
It was owned during World War II by Eddie Rickenbacker.
Really?
Yeah, he bought it after, obviously, after World War I. And he made the decision, apparently, to cease racing there during the war. Because obviously there was a greater need for the materials that went into the cars and obviously the fuel that went into the cars towards the war effort. So there was no racing at the IMS during the war. But yes, it was owned by Rickenbacker at the time.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. So he, I mean, you know, you make the assumption that he obviously had some sort of passion for motor racing. Otherwise, he wouldn't have bought one of the most famous racetracks on the planet, would he?
Yeah. Wasn't he quite big on the board speedways, possibly before the First World War, even?
Yeah, believe so.
Mm.
It was an interesting little factoid.
Yeah. Mm. It's kind of reminds me of, you know, the Wings, the 1927 film about the, you know, World War One combat. But before they go off to France, they're building a special based on a Ford or something like that, presumably, and you know, early automotive history. So
because for me, the ones that sort of popped into my head were AFP Fane, very well known pre-war racer, photo recon pilot, flew Tony's A810 and crashed trying to get back to Duxford, and he in fog at low level and he flew down the wrong railway line and hit a hedge, which in fog when he should have been going off to photograph the Subpens at Wilhelmshaven. But anyways, that's that. But the one I did want to mention, which is remarkable in so many different ways, is Roberta Cowell. So Roberta was the first male to female transgender person in the UK. But before she transitioned, she was a racing driver, raced at Brooklands quite a bit, and was a fighter recon pilot for Squadron. So was with Jumbo, Mujumar, all of those guys. And she was shot down in EK-49, one of the Typhoon FR aircraft in 18—I should have it here. 18th of November, 1944, and ended up in Stalag Luft 1. For the duration. So utterly amazing life. Definitely look it up. I did immediately start looking to see if I could get her autobiography, but it's thousands of pounds. It was a small edition run, but very, very interesting. Lots of articles about her life and the interesting situation she found herself in the prison camp, but definitely look her up. And yeah. Fane as well. He was a bit of a boy. But there will be more about him as well later. But now we're all together. We got to do this. We're leaving the only link to the Second World War is that, you know, Adam and I were roasting next to an ex bomber base with a Red Bull Racing employee shouting the C word at Lewis.
Oh yeah. So much. Oh yeah. What a day that was. Yeah.
For context, people, we met up at the British Grand Prix last year, and Sebastian Vettel, we'll get onto him in a minute. Max Verstappen threw himself at Lewis Hamilton one corner before where we were sitting. So if he had the good grace to wait until Chapel Beckett's and all that, we would have had it right in front of us. But
yeah,
Abu Dhabi, what do you think? Go.
Yeah, I've got to be careful what I say here because, as you know, Matt, I am a big Lewis Hamilton fan. A complete farce, broken rules, you know, whatever you want to pluck out of the air of everything that feels wrong about the sport at the moment sort of culminated in this event, I believe. There was things leading up to it, I suppose, that felt very much like the FIA weren't in control necessarily of certain situations in the season. a certain Mr. Massey looked like he'd lost control of a number of races that season, last season. But, you know, who knew that he was going to come up with what he came up with on the final day. Bullied, I think, is the right word, by team principals. And, you know, I'm not naive enough to say that, you know, that doesn't involve those at the Mercedes garage. But certainly on that final day, he made a glaring error that essentially won Max Verstappen his championship, in my opinion. And people, you know, people will bring up, and I saw a video online earlier again, people still talk about it all the time, that Max Verstappen led more races and that he, you know, he won more races and this, that and the other. And unfortunately, that's not how sport works. At the end of the day, whoever's got the most points wins the championship. And up until the final lap of that race, Lewis Hamilton had the most points. And until Mr. Massey came along with his odd ruling for that final lap, the championship was Lewis Hamilton's. And that is how sport works. You can't, you know, you don't win sport on statistics. You know, you win it on the important things. And Lewis Hamilton had done what he needed to do that day, I believe, to win the title. I believe the last four races of that season were Lewis at his very best. He was at his very best in that race as well. He was putting in excellent lap times on very old tyres. But unfortunately, you know, somebody expected him to fight off Max on the same tyres whilst Max had brand new shoes on. So it's fast is probably the right word in my mind.
I agree. And I think it's, yes, the race itself was a farce, but then the subsequent cover-up and attempts to justify it were worse. Because I think it's, if someone screws up, and if someone screws up that badly, you know, who hasn't screwed up? I've made some horrendous mistakes in my life. I'm sure we all have. But, you know, the mark of kind of the test that applies to us is to admit to it and try and put it right. And I know with the FIA, as far as the FIA and Formula One were concerned, there was no doubt an awful lot of money and other stuff, and it would have opened one hell of a can of worms if they had afterwards said, yeah, we screwed this up. It should have happened in the way it did, but we're going to try and put it right. And what trying to put it right would have looked like, I have no idea. And we'd probably still be in court now if that had happened. But I think, you know, even for Massey on an individual level to come out, or now he's not in that job anymore, what's stopping Massey saying, actually, you know, the pressure got to me. I shouldn't have done, well, having said that, I suppose if he says that, then, you know, he opens up the FIA to legal challenges and all that kind of stuff. And this is probably where it gets more complicated. But I just think it was, that's the thing that really hurt for me, was not, yeah, I mean, it was, I was screaming at the screen, and it was a nonsensical application of the rules, and quite why he thought he had the authority to do what he did at the time, to kind of take one thing that he could authorize, but only partially. And yeah, anyway, it was just,
well, there were signs that, you know, that he had the potential to maybe make that sort of decision. Obviously, the Grand Prix previous at Jeddah, you know, tried to make the deal with Red Bull, you know, and it's, you know, there's either a rule or there's not, you know, you don't make deals with these teams, you know, so it's, you know, like you say.
Yeah, and I think obviously you've got, then you sort of go back to the whatever deal was cooked up with Ferrari over their engines and things like that. And it's like, and then the whole way Formula One is set up now with the strategy group, which involves the teams. And I think maybe we need a situation in which the teams are the organizations that participate in the sport, and the rule makers are the people who set the rules. And, you know, Formula One is the body that organizes it. And there are sort of actual delineations between those organizations, and, you know, everything's written in concrete terms that everyone understands, and there can be no confusion. But, you know, it's, as I think it was Frank Williams that said, it's a business all times apart from 2 hours every other Sunday. I don't want to be conspiracist about it, and I don't think there was a conspiracy as such, but I think there was a lot of pressure for there to be a different winner than Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've said really since Max has been in the sport is that they go easy on him because he's box office. And Max drives in a way that I don't think should be allowed. And he's been allowed to get away with driving in that way. And he's been enabled in that by both by his team and by the governing bodies, because he has a big fan base, because there are a lot of people excited by him, because he's, you know, he has helped bring new audiences into Formula One and things like that. And I think we've got to the point now where we have, because people have turned a blind eye to the way that he drives. And it's that more than anything else that sort of put me off Formula One. You know, I still watch it, I still follow it, but I don't have the same enthusiasm I did over it even a couple of years ago, really.
Yeah. I mean, I'm finding it very difficult to get enthused over new cars, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, they look very clumsy on the track. You know, it's evident that, you know, a certain few teams have applied the new regs pretty well, other teams haven't. I don't really think it's made the racing any different to what it was before. Personally, you're still looking at cars only really making overtakes in DRS zones, for example. And, you know, there's not a great deal. You know, we were, they made it sound like it was going to become like a touring car, basically. And it hasn't really, has it? And to be honest with you, I would sooner watch a touring car race. You know, it's almost illegal in a touring car race not to pull in at the end of the race wearing somebody else's paintwork. You know, and that's what racing should be, in my mind. As long as it's within, you know, the parameters of, you know, what is safe and what the regulations are, then, you know, it makes for great racing. But, you know, I find it funny you made a comment about, you know, the application of regulations and, you know, how seriously the FIA take them. And at the moment, they're taking regulations over wearing the right sort of pants and not wearing jewellery in a car.
Oh my God.
You know, yeah. Very, very seriously. But apparently it'd be, you know, when it comes to actual regulations during a race, they can be flexible with those, which I find very contradictory.
I mean, the new cars, I think I was quite excited about those sort of when they were introduced. And I think, you know, the bringing more ground effects in. And I actually think Ross Brawn had a decent approach. I was, you know, pleased when he took over the sort of technical side of it. And there was a talk that he did here at Southampton Uni just before he took on that role, where he was talking about his approach as a team boss, or as a technical boss for a team, and how he would apply it. Because, you know, I think it was at the time it was a sort of a fairly open secret that he was certainly in the running for that role. So he was talking about how he would act, you know, what he would do if he was given that role. You know, and it's very much more systematic than things had been. And we had those really ridiculous 2017 regulations where I think it was, you know, tail end of Bernie era, and he decided the cars aren't fast enough. They need to be faster and not actually pay any attention to the racing whatsoever. So they just bolted more downforce on them and given them bigger tires. And I think it's, you know, we have to go back to the fact that actually the racing was quite considerably better in sort of, you know, up to 2016. And people complained about the overtaking then, but, you know, it got significantly worse when they brought in those, the wider cars and the bigger wings and all that stuff. And then you actually, the whole time I've been interested in Formula One, going back to the 80s, people have been complaining about not enough overtaking. And I think maybe people kind of needed to calm down at times, because it sort of feels like everything they've done has made it worse ever since. You know, certainly I remember the regulations back in 89 were supposed to improve the racing over 88. And I suppose, you know, you had the situation in 88 where it was McLaren dominated everything, and it wasn't like it wasn't an exciting season. The cars are too big and hit too heavy. I don't think you'd struggle to find anyone who disagreed with that viewpoint. And it's just, but having said that, I remember the Indy cars, the sort of the Indy cars of the mid 90s, they were big, heavy cars, and yet they managed to race well on street circuits. So they need to make the car smaller and lighter. They need to be more nimble. You know, a racing car, the ultimate racing car, which Formula One is kind of supposed to be, it doesn't necessarily have to be the fastest. There've always been faster series than Formula One, but it kind of feels like it has to be the ultimate in when you take everything in the round. And it feels like they should be more nimble, more agile, cars that you can kind of race with and these kind of big lumbering things. And also it just sort of shows that the fact that they've, the tires again, it's always seems to be the tires seem to be the limiting factor. Like in Miami, it was like, yeah, it's great on the racing line, but we've kind of spent millions and millions on these new aerodynamic regulations that make the cars easy to follow each other. But then you give them only one racing line. You can't move off that racing line, no matter what the aerodynamics are doing. So it's like, come on. These people are supposed to be clever.
I think my biggest gripe with the new regs is they bottled it slightly on the ground effects. If you're going to allow ground effects, curved undersides, go whole hog, put the skirts on them, and then strip off the aero on the top. You know, there was always going to be, as soon as they had open-sided bottoms, open-sided bottoms, porpoising was going to happen. It was going to hit somebody badly, and it was going to hit someone else less. And I was sitting all here as Lewis fans, but you know, I think as soon as they announced that, it was like, well, that's not really going to do enough. And I just think cars look cool. It's nice to see that they all look quite different to a degree. I think the Ferrari looks really cool, actually. And it's nice to see them winning. I really wish Carlos would figure out how to keep it out of the wall. It is really interesting. But just to wrap up, we were talking about something earlier. It's been cropping up more recently with Seb's struggles. Is this Red Bull's greatest racer? It's obviously Sebastian Vettel. But have we reached this point that we are so enamored with, say, the immediacy of things like Drive to Survive, social media, which is immediate, that we are forgetting just how good, Seb was? Forgetting, we think of Lewis and his 7 titles, 8 with a star next to them, and we forget the years that he battled Seb in the Ferrari. Was it 2017, 2018? Granted, Ferrari had a trick engine, but we won't get into that. But he was incredible. Why is it? Am I thinking right that our memories have gotten so short for the general fan base, or is it something else?
There is always a recency bias. Always a recency bias. When I worked at Autosport, and it was during the Schumacher era, and it was just at the beginning of his Ferrari dominance, so many people back then considered Schumacher to be like absolutely unquestionably the greatest of all time. And I completely disagreed with that then, and I disagree with it now. But now, if you look at the sort of lists of, people talk about Hamilton a lot, and people are starting to talk about Max as the greatest ever, which is a complete joke, if you ask me. Utter, utter joke in so many ways. I don't actually even think he's all that good. But anyway, so it's a few. I think there's always this kind of zone that's a few years ago. We're not kind of far enough back to be classic yet, but it's long enough ago that people have kind of forgotten the immediate sense of it. And I think Seb's 4 titles kind of fall into that zone at the moment. That's my theory. Because his mastery of those particular cars, particularly with the blown diffuser, was just unparalleled. I don't think anyone, Hamilton, I think you'd have to say from the hybrid era on was the better driver, and he has got better and better and better, and his mastery of those cars is something to behold. But Seb, in that particular era, at the 2010 to the mid 2010s, just nobody could touch him for the way he could drive those cars and get a lap time out of them. That's my take anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's an element of the way that F1 fandom's changed over the last few years, because it's obviously become a more popular sport. Social media means that the way that people talk about races and talk about drivers is becoming more like, how football fans talk about teams. A lot of it's very toxic, I find, and it makes me sad to think that F1 is going in that direction. And I feel like there's an awful lot of fans, and I'm not being judgmental towards those that are new to the sport, but I just don't think they've got a great grasp of sort of F1 history. And it goes back to what you said, Matt, but they don't, they probably didn't see Seb race, and they probably don't care enough to go back and look at actually how good he was. They just see, like you say, who's, somebody who's popular now, or someone who they perceive to be better now. But Seb was annoyingly good. I used to really hate him. I really like him now because he's mellowed a lot and obviously he's doing great things outside of sport. I believe he's on, is he on Questing Time? Is it tonight or is it tomorrow?
It's tonight, yeah, I think.
Yeah, yeah, which tonight, I find yeah. weird, but good on him. You know, I think that's great. So I used to hate him, but, you know, it was hatred born out of whether I was willing to admit it or not, the fact that he was just that good, you know, and there was, you know, I did want to see other drivers win, but, you know, at the same time, you can't ignore the fact that he was, you know, a seriously, seriously good driver.
It was that counterintuitive driving style, wasn't it, of keeping his foot on the gas when he really shouldn't have had his foot on the gas to keep the diffuser planted. That was just mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, he's such an intelligent driver in terms of technically, I think. And while I don't think he was ever the best wheel-to-wheel racer, he kind of didn't need to be. He was sort of in that sort of Jim Clark frame of being able to race off into the distance and not need to do the wheel-to-wheel stuff. But, I mean, I didn't like him at the time because, I mean, I was a bit of a Webber fan, I have to say. I interviewed Webber a few times when I was on the magazine and before then, and I liked his approach, and he was more of a kind of character I could get to like. So it was sort of with his kind of intra-team battle with Seb, and I didn't, you know, I thought in some ways I think Seb's behavior sometimes crossed a line within the team, and Red Bull kind of enabled him in the way that they're doing with Max now. But since then, I think it's lovely to see someone grow up in the sport like that and actually, you know, really see their character grow and develop and become a kind of really, really good man, I think. Yeah, I just wish he was in a competitive car and could sort of show what I believe he's still capable of.
For sure. Right. Sophie's reminding Adam that it's getting late.
No, she was actually asking me which F1 driver we were talking about.
Oh, she can join in.
I think she was getting very worried that that Matt was talking about Max for a second then. So I was just reassuring her. Because you know, as you know, Matt, you experienced the intense levels of love that my wife has for Lewis Hamilton, who she would leave me for in a heartbeat for. Yeah. So she has this intense hatred.
She can be assured that no good word about Max Verstappen will ever pass my lips.
Yeah, that's very much the case in this household, I have to say.
Yes, yeah. I think out of the four of us that were at that race last year, she was the one who was more likely to give that RBR employee a slap for.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're planning on sitting in the same place this year, and I'm very much hopeful that that guy won't be there.
Yes, that's a good spot. We won't say where it is because, you know.
It's
a good spot. Anyways, gentlemen, this has been a real giggle. We've been going on far too long, and who knows? Maybe we should do this again. Put the aviation world to rights and get things out. So, Adam Berry, Matthew Willis. Thank you so much. And we'll have you back individually for the business because we've got to do the Duncan chat as well, Matt, haven't we? So, anyways, thank you so much. And we'll be back soon. What I have lined up next, I'm not sure. It's probably going to be B25 Mitchell related because, yes, living rent-free in my head at the moment, folks. So we'll do some of that. But, gents, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.